Welcome back to the Veterinary Viewfinder. This week, service dog shenanigans. You cannot believe these stories. Welcome back to the Veterinary Viewfinder, the podcast that tackles the toughest topics in veterinary medicine. And this week, we are going to be talking about service dogs. What is a service dog? What's not a service dog? Are people abusing the system? And what is our role in it as veterinary professionals? But first, as always, I am your host, Dr. Ernie Ward.
I'm Dr. Cindy Courtney.
And I'm registered veterinary technician, Becky Mosser.
News broke this week, guys, that Delta Airlines has announced that they are banning all pit bull breed types of service dogs. Now, first of all, I don't know exactly what a pit bull breed is. I think I have an idea. But Becky, as someone who works an awful lot with service dogs, what the heck is going on?
Yeah, I know. This is a crazy time for a service dog industry. It's sort of exciting because I think that anyone in the industry would agree we need some cinching down. But also these kind of blind bans and you know, pit bull breeds are not the issue. Let's be clear. It's the people who are comfortable being, you know, dishonest about the need for their dog to be in public that is really causing the problem.
Yeah, it really is. So, Cindy, as veterinary professionals, we're often caught in the middle of this, which we will definitely be getting to because Becky has a wealth of experience that. But, you know, isn't that part of the problem here? I mean, like, what is a service dog?
Yeah, and actually, I would love to lean on Becky's expertise here because one of the things that I encounter frequently, and I don't know how much you guys do, but I'll have clients come in with a newly adopted dog or a new puppy, and they'll tell me, you know, I want this specific dog to be a service dog. I want to make this my service dog. And they don't seem to understand that generally speaking, you know, for say dogs for the blind, those dogs are raised as puppies, specifically bred to this task. And that's how we get service dogs in most cases. So I guess, Becky, and frankly, I don't know enough about it to know. My assumption is that you can't just take any dog and make them a service dog to a specific task. Am I wrong there?
Well, I mean, you know, I can't say you're wrong because the fun thing is that most dogs will do what we ask of them. It doesn't mean that they make a great service dog, and it does depend on the task. And for a successful service dog and for ease of training, we wouldn't go in and just pick any dog for any task. I can say, though, there are a lot of organizations that do pull from shelters. They look for dogs that have specific breed, you know, and disposition qualities. And those dogs are intensely trained for about 2 years, whether they're raised as puppies or whether they're pulled from a shelter. You're talking about 2 years or more of specific training. I think the thing that we need to say here is, what is a service dog? By definition, a service dog is a dog that has been trained to mitigate a disability by providing a task. And it has to have been specifically trained to provide that task. There is no designation as to who needs to do the training. So people can self-train their own dogs, or they can professionally be trained by an organization such as 3K9, who I work with. But the dog has to have been trained to mitigate a disability by providing an actual task. The mere presence of that dog making them feel better puts them into an emotional support animal. And those dogs are not afforded any kind of public access. And that's sort of where the lines seem to get blurred.
Right. But Becky, like you said, they're actually also blurred because of the oversight, because the regulation of these dogs is a little bit loose. So even as you mentioned, you can have a service dog that you quote unquote self-trained, which I think is problematic in and of itself.
Sure. And, you know, I think the biggest problem is when you use the word regulation and disabilities, you start to run into trouble, right? Like, we can't require disabled people to register as disabled, or even, you know, technically registering a dog is registering yourself as disabled. And so I do think that going forward, service dog vests need to be regulated, much like parking stickers for the handicapped. And I understand that there is dishonesty when it comes to parking stickers, for example, but there is some more regulation that goes directly through the person and their doctor, and that's how there's an obtaining of that personal designation that says, I get this specific public access right, which in this case is closer parking. But again, we have to think about when people say register a service dog, you're asking people to register themselves as disabled. And under our society rules right now, that's discrimination.
Yeah. And, you know, as someone who is epileptic and, you know, I'm not in a place where I have a service dog, but certainly there are people who have animals who can detect their aura and can tell them when they're about to have a seizure so that they can be somewhere safe so that they can lay down. You know, those, you don't necessarily want to walk around, you know, having a big sign on you that says like, hey, by the way, I'm epileptic, since that can lead to discrimination in right. hiring and in how people treat you. You just want to be treated like a normal person and
absolutely,
you know, having that, having to register or having this big flag that says, you know, I have an illness or I have a disability can be pretty tough. Becky, I think if you can you clear up for us? I think there's a lot of confusion surrounding what the rules and what the laws are surrounding what is and isn't acceptable when you're asking someone about a service animal and, you know, what is okay? Like in terms of if the service animal is putting other people at risk, is that okay or not? If someone's asking someone about their service animal, obviously they're not allowed to ask about that person's disability. Are they allowed to ask about the task the animal does? What are the rules there?
You know, and those are great questions because people's lack of confidence in having these conversations is what leads to so much fraud, in my opinion.
Right.
The fact that people know they're not going to be asked in public and that they have a quick out. So by law, the manager of a facility or an employee of the facility, whoever's been designated. So it is not my right to ask somebody in a store these questions, but management or above these types of people who are invested in the public access area can say two questions. Is that a service animal? And what tasks does that animal provide? So you can't ask about disabilities. And, you know, a lot of times right now in public, what we see is people have that go-to, I'm diabetic, you know, because they know of diabetic alert dogs. You know, they know diabetes falls under what we call invisible disabilities. So, you know, much like you, Dr. Cindy, outside of having a seizure, no one would know that you had any kind of disability just looking at you. So, that's where we run into a little bit of trouble, but those are the two questions that can be asked. In terms of going a step further with that, there are absolutely times that a service dog can be asked to leave an area. And again, I think this is where people really need empowerment because they feel uncomfortable. But if the service animal is threatening the safety of the public, so growling, barking, lunging, any type of behavior like that, or if they impede the normal business process. So a good example we use of this is a service dog who's barking through a movie. You know, the normal function of a business is for there to be quiet. And so if the dog cannot be, it is just impeding and disrupting the normal function of that business. And they can be asked to leave in those cases.
Wow. But so, Becky, an individual can't, right? I mean, that's what you're saying. So if you see a service dog in a movie theater and it's barking, you can't do anything about it as an individual, but you could go complain to the owner or manager. Is that right?
It would be the appropriate thing to do would be to go talk to management about it. Although if you feel unsafe, if you don't feel safe, I think you absolutely have the right, but you can't demand they leave the property any more than like if I had body odor sitting next to you at the movie and you couldn't ask me to leave because I stink. Like it's just the rules of society, right? I have as much right to be there. Now, to be fair, the one thing we do want to clear up is that this is public access. So we're talking about anywhere that the general public is allowed to be. So if you're talking about a private club or say a private golf course, and then even areas where church and state separate, right? So religious facilities, these are places that service dogs are not necessarily permitted just without any kind of permission because they're private areas. So the rules kind of change when it comes to a private area as well. But you do want to stick to management. And the other thing that, you know, is important to note is that whatever service that they're being denied because of the access of the dog, so whether it's a private facility and they won't let them in, or if there's some kind of issue with the dog, maybe is having a bad day. Because I do want to say service dogs can have bad days. They can bark. Mm-hmm. They can have odd behavior. It could easily be what's going on with the person. The person does have to be offered the service at that facility in the absence of the dog.
Wow, this is really fascinating. Now, I think, Becky, no one listening would disagree that, you know, there are people with legitimate needs that need to have access to their service animal. I mean, wherever, almost. I think that's important. But what we're really seeing lately is this backlash against all this emotional support. I mean, you know, we're seeing people, you know, take, you know, a bird on a plane, you know. I mean, all kind of, there was an ostrich, right, down in Miami at an airport or something. So, Becky, explain the difference now between this emotional support and, you know, these people that go online, fill out a form, pay $50 and get a sticker to put on a vest.
Yeah. So to be fair, there again is no registration of any type of these animals at all. So if you're asking for a certification or a registration card, this is you can absolutely be presented one that's false. There are a lot of organizations that do work with these certifications because it makes everyone feel better and it makes public access easier. But there's nothing legit about any of these certifications and registrations. And I do have to say, regardless of what the county or the state law is, the ADA federal government trumps all these laws. And I always kind of equate it to marijuana laws. Like marijuana is still illegal no matter where they're selling it legally. So the ADA is over that. When it comes to emotional support animals, these are animals that have no specific training. They just make you feel better by being there. And so, you know, we would argue all of our dogs fall under that, right? The ADA, and another thing you have to understand is that there are a couple governing bodies. So the ADA affords public access. However, the Air Carrier Act is an additional federal law that protects animals on the plane. So when an animal is on an airplane, they fall under the Air Carrier Act, not the ADA laws. And that's why we're having this craziness. ADA only recognizes dogs and miniature horses as service animals. When it comes to emotional support animal, this can be any type of animal. So it can be that snake, that ostrich, whatever it is. Air Carrier Act has protected the public access of emotional support animals on planes pretty much fully until this point. And I think that's what's really going to change. So the Air Carrier Act does recognize the public access allowing of animals onto planes. And this is where we've gotten into various species. The ADA only recognizes dogs and miniature horses as service animals. Emotional support animals don't get public access except for airplanes. So if someone is in the grocery store and says, this is my emotional support dog, that dog has no right to be in the grocery store. On an airplane, however, they're currently still protected. And I'm disappointed to see Delta make the move to breed specific banning when it comes to emotional support. They are narrowing down species as well, right? And saying that this needs to be pretty much to dogs. And so we're not allowing emotional support birds like we had been and snakes and all the crazy things that I've been sent over the internet. But with no official training and no required training for emotional support animals, these are basically pets being allowed on planes for free. And this is where we're getting into a lot of trouble.
Yeah, and they're really ruining it for the legitimate needs, right? So Cindy, I mean, you know, I think we've all been exposed to some bad stories, but I mean, what has your experience been as a veterinarian? Have you seen like a quote unquote emotional support or whatever go badly?
Yeah. And I think this puts us in an especially tough position when we're veterinary professionals, because sometimes we feel like we need to do something, right? You know, especially if it's potentially putting the animal in harm's way as well. So I actually would like to share a story that happened to me just last week. So as you guys may have seen on our Facebook page, I was hoping that I might be able to see Becky when I was traveling to Wilmington. Unfortunately, our schedules got a little bit too crazy and we weren't able to make that happen. But as I was flying in, there was an emotional support animal on the plane, and they were wearing a vest and it had the name on it. It didn't like have a label that said emotional support animal or service animal, but it was clearly implied. And the dog was a pit bull mix, or it appeared to be. Again, 50% of the time we think something is a pit bull. It's actually not if you do DNA and genetic testing. So I have no idea how they're even going to try and enforce that. But the dog was actually really, really well behaved. What kind of clued me into the fact that I didn't think this dog was a trained service animal was actually how the owner was behaving. And so the owner seemed very flustered and seemed to think that the dog was behaving really badly, even though the dog was being very good. It was being very calm. It wasn't bothering anybody. It was sitting quietly and nicely on its seat. And at one point, you know, not only was the owner kind of punishing the dog with language and kind of jerking the dog's leash, but at one point the owner actually kind of did one of those soft slaps to the dog. And I don't know about you guys, but I've seen owners actually do that in the exam room with me. And I've had to, you know, talk to them about the fact that this kind of training can actually be counterproductive. It can lead to increased aggression. It can lead to violence. It can lead to biting. And so, you know, I felt extremely torn because, of course, I'm a veterinarian. I haven't identified myself as a veterinarian to anyone on this plane, but I'm worried about the well-being not only of the dog, but of the owner and of eventually other people who might come into contact with this animal on the plane if the dog starts becoming a very nervous or scared surrounding flying on the plane. The vest that the dog was wearing was not only like suggestive that it was a support animal, but it was in camo. So I was under the impression that the owner might have had a military background as well. And so I was concerned that, you know, maybe this owner has some PTSD. I don't know what his background is. So to be really honest, what I ended up doing is I just reached out and I said, you know, hey, I'm a veterinarian. I don't know if you're familiar, but there is an organization here in Wilmington that does do some training for service animals. So just kind of trying to make him aware that there were organizations to try and help provide training. And that's at that point, what I felt was the best that I could do, the most I could help without making him feel judged and maybe completely turning him off or making him angry. So, and I don't know if that was the right thing to do. And I wonder, Becky, if you can dissect some of that situation and tell us a little bit more about what might have been happening.
Yeah, you know, a couple things there. So first of all, the first thing I will say is that I hate to use the word legitimate here, but I'm going to. So like a legitimate service dog handler, you'll find that they actually are the worst critics of their dog's behavior. And so what most people think is perfectly good behavior is getting corrected on a regular basis because of the expectation we set for our own pets, right? So most dogs walk a solid 20 feet in front of their owners pulling them along down the road. I see it all the time. Whereas if my service dogs are 2 feet in front of us, I'm making a correction. To you, that probably looks like a really good heel, but maybe I need that dog to be shoulder to leg with me and checking in every 30 seconds, and that's not happening. Right. Gotcha. So depending on the behavior he was wanting from the dog, so in theory, he could have been wanting deep pressure therapy or some kind of distraction behavior, and the dog wasn't actually providing that task as he would have hoped, which in that case is warranting a correction on his end. Absolutely never negative conditioning, but I have to say there are a lot of service dog training organizations out there, not ours, but that do use aversives and do use fear-based command. This is when you see somebody who can turn a service dog or any dog, you know, you see a lot of private training say, and I know I'll get in so much trouble for this, but private trainers say, I can make your dog a service dog in 3 weeks. Most of the time they're using an aversive to demand that behavior from the dog. And we see long-term issues with that a lot of times. So I agree with you, operant positive conditioning always. But I won't necessarily say he was not getting the behavior that he actually wanted, even if the dog looked like he was, if the dog was being very aloof, he really could have needed that dog to be checking in with him and paying better attention.
Gotcha.
That being said, like you said, if this is most of the time you see some form of camouflage on a vest, it is a veteran's dog. And these guys do absolutely have psychiatric services as well as emotional services, as well as physical services being provided by various types of dogs. I don't know what to think since there wasn't actual identification on the dog saying one or the other. That makes it a little bit hard. But my guess is that that dog may have had a task it should have been providing despite its being really good. It may have been being checked out and he could have been trying to get his dog to check back in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And again, that just kind of highlights how, you know, it is hard for us, even as veterinary health professionals, to understand what this should look like, what it does look like. And again, like you said, you know, it sounds like, especially because there isn't any kind of formalized training, it's hard to know in some ways the welfare of these animals through the training process.
Yeah, it absolutely can be. And obviously, I think you did the right thing because number one, so I have to say, especially when it comes to our veterans, and you guys know I can preach this. I live with the one. I work with them. I live with PTSD. I work around PTSD. Yeah. I know what this looks like. The number one thing I hear from these guys is I don't want to be a scene. I don't want to be the center of attention. I don't want to make a scene. So again, any adverse behavior from their dog, they're really hypersensitive to. In fact, a lot of times my husband will not even go to dinner with me if I have a dog in training with me because he just doesn't want to be the person in the restaurant with the dog. He just does not like to be that center of attention. And so that's 100% goes on with a lot of people who have service dogs, I find, especially in my experience at being veterans. So I really appreciate that you didn't shame him, that you did, you know, just kind of reach out and give some information because sometimes people really want their dog to be a service dog and it may or may not be, and they do need some guidance or training. I think you did the exact right thing. You were soft, you were gentle, you were understanding, you know, you didn't shame him, but you offered some help.
But Becky, this illustrates to me profoundly the need for some type of universal accepted designation. Yeah, I mean, because the issue really with Cindy in this setting is she doesn't know what the heck's going on, right? Yeah. There's no like official handicap parking sticker, right? I mean, like if I see a handicap park, you know, car with the sticker on the in the parking lot, I don't question, right? You know, and I see people sometimes going, "What?" You know, but I think if Cindy were in that situation and it was an official badge or blaze or whatever on the dog, you would go, "Okay, this is a person that has been trained properly, and I don't understand what's going on right now, but I'm going to accept it as normal."
So the line that we're walking is identifying someone as disabled. So when we put a handicap sticker on a car, we identify the car, not the driver. So that driver is not required to wear a t-shirt through the store that says I'm parked in a handicap spot. And that's kind of the difference that we're running into right now. I do think that there will have to be regulation. And for me, it falls under regulating the vests. Now, I purchase vests off of Amazon all the time because they're cheap and easy and I can, and I can get them in all different colors and sizes. But the fact that I can, it frustrates me as a service dog organization director, because if these were only obtainable through prescription, much like most durable medical equipment is, I think this is where we can really kind of try to cinch things down, is the regulation of the vest itself. I know that sounds crazy, but I think it needs to be as regulated as the parking sticker, and very much in a similar way is about the only way to pull the person out of it and make it about the actual piece of medical equipment, which in this case is the dog.
Which is like a car.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I get torn up about the idea of, you know, I absolutely get concerned about, again, the welfare of these animals. Are they being trained in ways that are conducive to the animal's welfare as well? But I also completely understand that, you know, if you have an animal who just happens to pick up on the fact that you, when your blood sugar is low or when your blood sugar is high, and now this animal is really helpful to you as a service animal, and you have a condition that might already be extremely expensive for you to treat, asking you to go through an expensive training and certification process can be really difficult for people who, a lot of folks with disabilities, I know for epilepsy specifically, people with epilepsy are 50% more likely to be unemployed because our condition can interfere with our ability to work or our ability to drive and get to work. So it definitely brings up some interesting issues to think about and to consider, for sure.
Sure. And there's absolutely no easy answer there. You know, I have to say, I do think that it's going to come down to these dogs being looked at a lot more similarly like medical equipment. And I do think there needs to be more regulation in the training itself. That being said, you know, right now it's pretty much ADI, and that's just one organization who has created the standards. And in the veterinary side of things, you know, we have AVMA and AHA, and we have all these various things we can sort of follow with guidelines. Can we drill down just to one? It's a hot topic right now on every side.
Yeah, it's got to be, Becky, because the ramifications are real. Because what has just happened is, in response to all of this nonsense and confusion, Delta, like other airlines, is just saying, you know what, we're done. Yeah. You know, I mean, we're going to go right to the edge of what we can, and we're going to disallow as many as possible. And that's not fair either. You know, that's not the solution.
No.
But I can understand where they're coming from, because, Becky, I believe this latest Delta action was the direct prompt from an incident on an airplane. They felt threatened by this dog, and I think that there was words exchanged and maybe somebody hit a dog or something like that,
yeah.
Right? So I think Delta's just going, this is so disruptive. I mean, so what's your best advice? Like, as veterinary professionals, we are caught in the middle. I mean, we started out, Cindy, saying, you know, look, people come into our offices and say, I want this dog to be a service dog. We are requested to give health certificates for airline travel. I mean, what should we be doing, looking for? How can we help?
Right. Thank you for asking that, because it really, I do think we have a responsibility. And I'll tell you, I started lecturing on this on the veterinary circuit when I was walking through conferences, watching people put what I know are vests on their pets to bring them to veterinary conferences with us. And so if we're okay with it as veterinary professionals, we're not going to discourage it in our clients. And that was my biggest frustration. So first of all, we need to be the leaders. Let's think about this from the pet standpoint. Like, pets don't want to go everywhere with you. They want to stay on the couch, and they want to chew on their bone, and they want to be really excited when you come home. It's stressful and worrisome for a dog to go to a grocery store, be on hot parking lots, to do all of the things that we do with them. So when you have clients come in and they say, I want this dog to be my service dog, the first thing you would say to them is, well, do you have a disability? And you're not asking them what their disability is, but do you have a disability? Because if they say, well, no, then it's important to say, well, then there would be no need for a service dog. End of conversation. If they say yes, it's none of your business really what it is, then to talk to them a little bit about the tasks that they would want the dog to do. And if you feel like this dog would be a good candidate for those tasks, and the dog very well may be. So then let's talk about then, how do we get the training for you? How do we help you get this to be a really well-trained service dog to provide this task that you need? The other thing is when they say, no, it's not, it's just that I love him so much and I really want him to go everywhere with me. The talking points that I usually bring to people are a few things. Number one, let's talk about allergies. If you're on a plane and there's a kid that's allergic to dogs, that kid has to get off, not you and your pet who you're choosing to fly. You know, I was just in Kansas City also and actually ended up missing Dr. Cindy as well. Crazy story, but did run into Kara Burns in the airport. And awesome. I was bringing a donated puppy back. We had just had this beautiful little Labrador donated, Golden Doodle donated. And I paid $125 to fly her back. And I thought of all the dogs in this airport paying to be flown right now. This is probably the last one who should be. She will grow up to be a service dog, but we absolutely pay the same. So it's important to remind people that what you're choosing to do for fun can affect other people's life. The second thing I say to people is something like, are you scared of snakes? Most people are scared of snakes, right? Like that's the majority of people. If they're not snakes, I default to spiders. And I say, what if you had to walk by an 8-foot ball python in the grocery store? Like just to get your milk. And then they're like, that's not even an option. I would go to another store. And I'm like, this is what it's like for people who are afraid of dogs. There are people out there who are viscerally and truly afraid of dogs. And they are forced to have dogs in their everyday life through service dog, you know, being in the industry. I think it's fine, you know, because I know service dogs that are well-trained, that they're going to ignore this person, but they're truly playing to this person's fear. And if I had to walk past a ball python at the grocery store every time, Amazon groceries, it would be for me, right?
Yeah.
So I try to use these types of examples to help people understand that I know you love your dog and you love your dog so much, but let's talk about the fact that not everyone out there does. And also your dog is twice as likely to get hurt, twice as likely to get sick. It doesn't want to be out and about doing all of these things.
Yeah. And Becky, I guess, you know, I kind of lose sight that a lot of people may be doing this to get out of paying for the pet.
Oh, 100%, right? It's $130 to get on the plane and they don't want to pay. And in fact, I was flying out to Kansas City and there's this lady who's got her dog in a pupusa and he's got a bow in his hair. And someone says, can I pet your dog? And she goes, yes, of course. It's my emotional support dog. I have diabetes. And I thought, you know, most people to be fair, small dogs are getting more and more in the service dog industry because people live in apartments. It is more convenient. In a place like an airport, they might carry them so they don't get stepped on. They might put a bow in their hair. I'm trying really hard not to be judgmental here, right?
Right.
But most people with disabilities don't offer up their disability, boom, first thing. And then when I hear that first thing, it's always a red flag to me.
Yeah.
And it is absolutely making life harder for the people who use it and need it. But in the airplane, it is about this $130 fee for so many people. $125 they don't want to pay to put their dog on the plane. And that's what it comes down to.
Yeah. And if the dog is working, you know, for most, at least my understanding is for most service animals, if they're supposed to be working, it's distracting to them to be getting pet and they're not able to do what they're supposed to be doing.
Yep.
And they can't do their task if they're being pet and distracted. And those
that's exactly right. And that's why we have the rules in society that we have. And you know, I'll tell you something though, as someone who has moved through life with a service dog in training, it gets really old telling people no. It gets really old listening to moms tell you, if you're not going to let my kid pet your dog, you shouldn't bring it in here. Aww. People are so mean and so hard on people with service dogs. It gets exhausting to not be able to walk in and out of a store without people kissing and clucking and talking and wanting to pet and dealing with it. You cannot run an errand in your life without twice as much time built in because of people's response to your service dog. And that's kind of the last thing I think I tell people when they're giving me, you know, the indication that they want to have a service dog and don't need one is, would you use a wheelchair just because you're too tired to walk? You really just wouldn't. And I guess there are some people that would, but it's kind of what it comes down to. People don't know how hard it is to move through life with a service dog, to always have to be. It is literally like having an infant for 6 years. You've got to have the poop bags. You've got to have the towels. You've got to have some food. You've got to watch the parking lots. You've got to take potty breaks. You've got to take water breaks. You have to deal with so much more in your life that it is a very insensitive thing for people to say, oh, I love my dog so much, I wish I could move through life with him.
Wow. I got to tell you, Becky and Cindy, this conversation has been so, so informative for me. I have learned so much. I've actually taken an entire page of notes, Becky. So well, yes. I've learned so much. But Becky, you know, aside from my notes that I have here, where can I go online? Is there like a website that you can point me to or something?
Sure. I mean, well, the ADA is the number one place to go. And actually, what a lot of people don't know is that you have regional ADA advocates that you can find in your area who can help you with the laws. They can come into your business and show and make sure you can come and listen to me on several of the lecture circuits. I know I'm lecturing at Western this year on service dogs and the laws. And there's old notes associated with VMX and Texas Veterinary Medical Association. So this lecture's out on the circuit. You can find it. ADA.gov is a great place to go for more information. You can always come to our website, which is 3K9WorkingDogs.org, 3K9WorkingDogs.org. I'm very proud to be a part of this organization and a part of Working Dogs. And I thank you guys so much for the time to have this conversation, because for me, it is really important. And I look to my veterinary professionals and colleagues out there to be the leaders in the industry, to not be writing letters in places they don't need to be, and to support the service dog community, because truly these working dogs, these service dogs, they're essential to our livelihood in terms of providing great care for them and creating these lines so that our clients know we stand on the side of service dogs and following the law.
Well, guys, this, I think our audience is going to love this. This is something that all veterinary professionals should know about. I think, Becky, you have definitely given me some information that, and I now want to go and seek out more.
Heck yeah.
But you know, we want to hear, what do you think about all of this? We haven't solved all the world's problems. We haven't, you know, fixed the service dog shenanigans, but we do want to know what you think about this issue. Have you seen problems in your world? And if so, what are some of the solutions that you'd like to offer?
Absolutely. And you can share those with us in so many places. You can find us on Facebook at Veterinary Viewfinder, on Instagram at Veterinary Viewfinder, as well as on Twitter at Vet Viewfinder. We also wanted to just take a moment to share some of the awesome reviews that you guys have been leaving us. We listen and read every single review that you guys read us. This one was from Busy Vet Practice Manager, who said that she thought we had an incredible podcast and that we and the topics and guests are interesting and inspiring, and that she looks forward to every episode and to keep them coming. And we just wanted to say thank you so much for leaving a review.
Thank you.
It keeps us going. And if you guys find this podcast helpful and you think you know somebody who would like it or that they would find it helpful as well, one of the greatest compliments you can give us is to go ahead and share that with them or to leave a review yourself. So thank you guys so much for your support. We appreciate it so much.
Thank you guys for all your kind words and for listening every week. When you're there leaving your review, don't forget to click to subscribe so you don't miss one great episode of the Veterinary Viewfinder.
Until next time, bye.
We love you.